Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast whose sole reason for existence is to remind you that this world is full of so much magic and so much mystery and inexplicable encounter, well, I can hardly stand it. And this episode's guest, Bart Merrill, has quite a story to share. There is a little bit of a trigger warning. Bart shares a story about the loss of his sister, and it's a little bit shocking and broke my heart a bit. Or a lot. So I want you to be careful with your hearts in case the topic is a sensitive one. Now, Bart shares a story of being an amputee and kind of the original whole story of how he came to need to have his leg amputated. But then the magical mystery miracle moment is about timing and his wife's health and then what needed to happen so that she could be safe. And as usual, it's mysterious and lovely and should remind us all that there are powers that we can only guess at that have our best interests at heart. So now, without further ado, let's get into my conversation with Bart Merrill.
So I was dropped from a ropes course back in 2012. And the belayer, it was at a personal development retreat in Canada. And so I get, when people ask me how I lost my leg, I tell them I didn't listen to my wife. And so my wife is big into feng shui.
Okay.
And I had this trip planned, purchased, airline tickets. I was on my way to Canada. About a month before I was supposed to leave, she comes out of her office and she says, "You can't go." "What do you mean I can't go where?" "You can't go to Canada. It's a bad direction." "I can't live my life on your feng shui." And so she protested a second, went back in her office, and then she came back out again. She says, "No. This is a horrible direction. It could affect you for the rest of your life." Here we are. So I am Bart Merrill. I call myself the Side Hustle Samurai, hence the samurai swords behind me. I help people identify their ideal side hustle and create financial security by monetizing the things that they already know and do. And how did this happen? It just, life takes you down different avenues. This wasn't the avenue I chose. It's the avenue that chose me, just by circumstances.
Okay.
So anything that crosses my path, good, bad, or ugly, I always ask, how can I monetize it?
Okay.
And we go from there.
Okay. Where did you grow up, by the way?
I grew up in a small town in southern New Mexico named Animas.
Cool.
So if you know the little boot hill of New Mexico?
Yeah.
Right there in the middle is where I'm from.
Wow. How did your family end up there? You know I'm in Santa Fe.
Oh, I didn't realize you're in Santa Fe.
Yes.
So my parents grew up in a town called Verdon, New Mexico, which is right on the Arizona border. And his dad was a produce something or another. And I'm not sure all the details on. And then my dad, he became a rancher. And then he decided that ranching didn't produce enough offspring. Cows didn't produce enough offspring. So then he went into pig farming. And he started a pig farm down in this Animas, New Mexico, and that's where I grew up. My high school was 200 students, 7 to 12.
Now that is a small town.
Yes, and Dad used to say it's where the West begins, and the road ends and the West begins, and that was true.
Oh my gosh. Did you ever get a chance to go to Carlsbad Caverns?
I did not. We actually had, so just across the border into Arizona in the Chiricahua Mountains, there is some caves called the Crystal Caves. Have you heard of them?
I have. And, yeah.
And they are, they're amazing. But it's not like calls. You go request a key and you take two or three people and go in a team and go by yourself. There's no, and we would tie off a string and follow the string down in and then follow the string back out.
This seems rather ill-advised. Are they still doing that?
So when I got married 26 years ago, they did. But it was, it's incredible. I mean, we were in there for an hour and a half. And I was there with my brother-in-law, who is a little, he is quite civil and a little nervous. And we were in there for an hour and a half going. No, actually, we were in there for longer. And when he decided, he's like, you know, I haven't seen the light in a long enough time. I need to get back out and see the light. And we hiked consistently out an hour and a half to get back outside. But it's just an amazing place. It's incredible.
Okay, I'm sorry. Is there the risk of getting lost in this place?
Like I said, we tied a string at the front and we took that string with us all the way and then we followed it back out.
Okay.
So and if you did not have the string, there is a risk of getting lost.
Okay. And did you wear headlamps or have flashlights?
Yeah, we had headlamps on and because it's, if you don't, I mean, it's pitch black. You can't see anything. And we never made it to the second gate, but there's two gates. And right after the second gate, there is a lake. And it has blind fish and stuff in it. We never made it that far. But people had been in it for 2 and 3 weeks and never found the end. And so it's just an amazing place. It's amazing.
Okay. I want to ask you, do you think that you, well, are you a spelunker? One. Two, do you think that you are, and this does, there's nothing negative in this. I'm not saying anything negative, but do you think you're like an adventurer or a risk taker? Is that kind of part of who you are?
Yes, I am an adrenaline junkie. One of my stupid claims to fame. So I helped take the first commercial bungee jump to Japan. While I was there, I jumped off my bungee tower, just hanging on to the bungee cord with my bare hands. And
what?
That is my stupid claim to fame.
That is crazy.
There was a reason behind it, kind of.
Oh my God. Okay, you have to know I have a terrific fear of heights. But then the idea of jumping off, I would probably pass out and it just wouldn't work. I'm the kind of person where I grew up, you know, after living overseas, I grew up in Chicago. So we'd go up, drive up a couple hours to Great America, where they would have the unbelievable roller coasters. And, you know, it was enough just to get me in the roller coaster. And then, you know how it like clicks up really slowly, clicking, clicking, clicking up to the really high where it's just going to go down. I always just wanted to throw up everywhere. Somehow I lived through it. But I can tell that it probably wouldn't have bothered you at all.
No.
Yeah.
I've done some pretty crazy things.
So heights don't scare you.
You know, as a kid, I would wake up with having a dream of being on a skyscraper or falling off a cliff or something. I don't know why I'm an adrenaline junkie, because as a little kid, I would be chased by something and I'd fall off a cliff or something like that. But it just, I don't know. It didn't really affect me.
That's so brave. Oh my God. Oh, you know, I think it takes a special kind of person just putting that out there to do these kinds of things. Okay. Can I ask you, is there maybe an adventure or some kind of adrenaline fix that you haven't done yet that you'd still like to do?
I've seen, so down in Moab, there is a swing that you jump off and it swings. It's like a really hard drop and then you swing out and it comes back. I've seen it. I haven't seen it live in person. That's something I would be interested in doing. Anything that's like that, I would be interested in doing. But after I got married, I did calm down a little bit, and my adrenaline rush now is speaking in front of crowds.
Okay. Okay.
That's my new safe adrenaline rush. But okay. I mean, anything like that. I've been skydiving several times, but that's still a rush. I would do that again if I could as well.
Okay. Okay. Can I ask if this is this genetic in your family?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. I mean, mom and dad never did it. But I'm the youngest of seven.
Okay.
And so they finally got it right with me. And so that's when all the good stuff came out.
Right? Right. Oh my God. Perfect. Perfect answer. Well, I have to say that I'm giving you kudos. I'm giving you applause because when I was in high school, I really wanted to work at our local swim, which was basically they had dug out an old limestone quarry when they were building the town. So a lot of the buildings were made of limestone. I mean, they dug and they dug and they dug and they dug and they dug. And then finally they hit a spring, which probably was just, you know, the river was very close nearby. So they probably hit. So at any rate, the quarry filled up. And for decades and decades and decades and decades, it was the swimming hole for the surrounding area. And then it became, I don't know, they put in a baby pool, which I think was a foot and a half deep. The medium, I think, got to 4.5 feet deep. And then the deep end, you'd be swimming and there would be reeds and other aquatic plants grabbing at your ankles. But I think at its deepest, it was about 30 feet deep. And you couldn't see the bottom at all. And if you wanted to lifeguard at this place, they had a 21 foot high tower and you had to be able to dive off that tower and do it with no hesitation. And so, you know, I, of course, worked my way up. You know, I started by jumping off and that was plenty for me. And then I remember the summer I decided to sit on the edge and dive off. I did that several times. And then one day I just got the gumption up to stand up and dive off. And I thought I might've graduated to being able to lifeguard here, but it was even 21 feet for me was pretty crazy. So
yeah.
I think some of us are meant to jump out of planes with parachutes and some of us just are not. And I'm the latter.
That's definitely, and some people will jump off bungee towers and some people won't. And then some people figure out how to do it with just their bare hands because they want to let go of it and fall to the mat below, you know?
Wow. Well, can I ask you just for my own edification, because I live in New Mexico, what did you do for fun in Animas as a kiddo?
As a kid, I mean, I don't remember not having a horse. Oh. And so every weekend we would saddle up the horses and go, you know, ride horses and stuff. At a very young age, I got into rodeo. So I got into team roping. And then obviously we would hunt and do the normal cowboy stuff or the, you know, stuff out in the middle of nowhere. But we would build forts. As a kid, it was an amazing place to grow up.
Oh, I bet.
From 5 years on, I was working with Dad on the farm. And sometimes he irritated me because he would say, "Hey, come help me." And then he would take me out in the middle of nowhere and say, "Okay, take these tires off this big truck." And then he would leave me there and go do something else. And he'd come back and say, "Dad, you said, come help me. I thought I was supposed to help you. You left me here." And he says, "Yes, you helped me here so I could go do something else." And so I grew up with that as a kid, you know, but a lot of animal stuff. I always had a dog, always had a horse. I raised pigs for the 4-H and showed pigs. We just did cool stuff like that.
Okay. Forgive my rodeo ignorance, but what is team roping?
So team roping is where you have one person that catches the head and the other person comes behind and catches the heels. And then you pull apart and that's when your time is done.
So it's like you are incredible with the lasso is what I think you're saying.
I was okay. I was a header. So I would catch the head. That's what I liked the best. And yeah, so I watch it now and it's mind blowing to me how fast they get it done.
Seriously. You know,
They're 4 seconds or below. And when I was growing up, if you were between 6 and 7 seconds, that was considered good. And now it's just like, I'm not even good anymore.
Yeah, I've been to a couple rodeos. I enjoy them. You know, it's really the people watching. I love watching the people. So many interesting, different kinds of people. And then, of course, the animals, beautiful horses. Oh, my goodness. But then, like you said, I mean, I think I watched barrel racing one time and I just could not even conceive of how fast these human beings were flying with their horses. It's astonishing. When you were growing up in Southern New Mexico as a kid, what did you dream about becoming?
So my dream job was to get in the FBI and chase serial killers.
Wow.
And that was from about 16 on. Yeah. As a kid, I went through different things. I want to be a cowboy. I want to be a rock and roll guitarist. But then from 16 on, I wanted to get in the FBI and chase serial killers.
Wow. Was that due to, like, was it something you saw on TV or something that you read? How did that happen?
I watched a movie called, called Manhunter.
Oh, yeah.
And so Manhunter was basically it was before Silence of the Lambs was made. And I believe Silence of the Lambs was kind of a remake.
Yes.
Of that. But it just in the Manhunter movie, the psychological warfare between the FBI agent and how he had to fight his own demons to not go because he was so deep into the serial killer's head. That psychological stuff just interests me. And that was, I'm just like, that's what I want to do. And of course, you know, you ask, is that was my thrill seeking genetic. My mom would always ask me, why would you want to do that? Why do you want a dangerous job? And I'm like, Mom, it doesn't matter what I'm doing. When it's my time to go, it's my time to go. There's nothing I can do about it. And she says, yeah, but, and then, oh, so then I go to Japan and I'm doing the bungee jump thing. And then the Sky Coaster, it's a big swing thing in all the big amusement park rides. So you get pulled up there and you can do one, two or three people. And one of them has to pull a ripcord and it's just this huge swing. And so I took that to Japan and then we built our own ride in Japan. And then my friends in Japan, the company that I was contracted with in Japan, they called me up and they said, hey, Bart, we saw on TV the other day, it's in Germany. It's a complete unattached free fall into a net from about 150 feet in the air. We want you to go try it. And I said, a free fall into a net from 150 feet in the air? That's got to hurt. Yeah, that's why we want you to go try it. And anyway, you know, it's called scad diving. And I called Germany. Germany said, oh, right now it's just for stunt people. We'll call you when it's ready for the public. And I'm like, okay, I'm never going to get a call back. 2 months later, they called me. I was on a plane to Germany. It was Hamburg, Germany in the middle of February. It was just so cold. And I went there. I tried it 3 or 4 times, then flew to Japan and we sold 3 of them in Japan. And then I built for the German company, one in Wisconsin Dells and one in Dallas, Texas. And anyway, falling from 150 feet in the air, it's only like 4 seconds, but it's amazing how many times during that short 4 seconds, I should have hit the net by now. I should have hit the net by now can go through your head because it's a long time.
Okay. So describe this to me. Do you have any safety equipment on whatsoever?
So you you fall into a net. I mean, so it's attached to a crane, at least the system that they had in Germany. And you pick it up and there's this probably 40 foot by 40 foot square net. And on the crane where it's connected on those four corners, it is bungee cord. And so when you hit the net, it cradles you. It doesn't hurt. Okay. And there's no, I mean, you're tied off up there and then you're hooked to this little, it's a release carabiner, and they lower you. You're in this harness to keep your hands in so you don't go like this and break an arm. And so you're sitting butt first, and they say, "Are you ready to go?" And you just go, "Yep." And they go 3, 2, 1, and they pop the release carabiner, and it releases you and lets you fall to the net. There's the one in Dallas, Texas. It's called Nothing But Net. Look it up. It's pretty interesting.
My God. Oh, okay. That, so your poor mother during all of these years of your adventuring, I mean, I'm sure she's like, what is happening here?
I would send her pictures or video of me on top of one of these towers doing, you know, I'm tied off, but I'm just like, "Hey, Mom."
Hey, you're hilarious and I love it, but you're also very brave. I don't have that gene that says bungee jumping's a good idea, so I'm glad someone does. So at least it's happening. So let me ask you the second question, which is, did you grow up in a religious household?
I did.
What did that look like? And then, you know, over time or over as you've gotten older, has that connection with what you can't define, God, whatever it is, spirit, has that changed at all or evolved?
So what did it look like? I went to church every week growing up all my life. The teachings were amazing. I grew up with two great parents. They were in the church as well. Dad was, sometimes he was one of the leadership in the church sometimes. Things that stick out to me. So when I was 5 years old, my sister, who was 10 years old, died. She was hit in the head with a baseball bat at school at recess on accident. And watching my parents go through that as a very young kid, because I don't remember a whole lot, but the stuff that I remember. So my mom was in California at my other sister's house, who had just had a baby at the time. And so it started, we got a call. I was home with a sprained ankle, and my dad got a call from school saying that Jolene, my sister, had been hit in the head with a baseball bat. She's okay, but she vomited a little bit, probably has a concussion. You should take her to the doctor. So we went and picked her up, took her to Dr. Baxter's office, who is the doctor in the town. And he says, "Well, we want to watch her overnight." So they put her in the small hospital in that town. And that night at about 4 o'clock in the morning, my dad got a call saying that she had passed away. She got a blood clot in her brain and she had died. I remember picking up Mom from the airport in Tucson, Arizona, and driving straight to the mortuary. Walking into that room with my sister laid out on the table, white sheet up to here, and watching my mom, you know, walk over, stroke her cheek, bend over and kiss her on the forehead and say goodbye. And so that really stuck out about how Mom took it. And then the person who swung the bat was her best friend. and she had swung at the ball and missed the ball and then spun around like a ballerina, and the bat accidentally hit my sister upside the head. The kids at school were calling her a murderer, calling her a killer, and were really mean. And I remember her coming to the house, wouldn't even get out of the car. My dad had to go out there, and she was just in tears saying she didn't mean to. I didn't mean to do it. And at a time that my dad needed comforting, the most he probably ever had to in his life, he found himself having to comfort this little girl and tell her it was okay. That it wasn't her fault, that Jolene was standing too close. And then years after it, Dad would often be in leadership positions, whether it's in the church or in business or in the community. And he would tell the story about how nobody wants to lose their child. But that experience gave him the empathy and the ability to relate and understand other people in his business dealings and his church dealings, and how that growth was so. It was an awful situation. He did not want it, won't wish it on anybody. But the growth that he gained from that situation made him who he was. And so those are the things that stick out in my head when it comes to religion, or, you know, was I a religious home, and how learning from my parents and how to go through stuff. And, you know, and it's just continued on, because life happens. You know, that's one of the things I talk about in what I do when it comes to monetize your mindset. Are you prepared for what happens when what happens happens, financially, emotionally? Because if you're not prepared before it happens, it's too late.
Yeah.
And so just learning that from my dad from a very young age. I mean, I was 5 years old. I remember standing by the grave at the graveside service. Remember, I couldn't walk because I had a sprained ankle. And I wanted to go over and see how deep the hole was, and my dad wouldn't take me over to look. You know, so just little things I remember. And the big things are the interactions with the girl who swung the bat.
Yeah.
And my mom not being there and having to say goodbye to her child who was already passed, who was already gone, and how they dealt with that. Has been very, you know, forming in my life because of that at a very young age.
Yeah. I want to say, first of all, how sorry I am about the loss of your sister and the pain that her loss, you know, gave, I suspect, the entire community.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about the compassion and forgiveness that your father showed that young girl. I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
In my wildest dreams, what she went through and probably is still going through to this day.
Yeah. She ended up having to move away.
Okay. Oh
yeah. It was sad for her. Very sad for her as well.
I'm so sorry. That is so, no one ever thinks when they send their child to school in the morning, they're not going to see their child again.
Yeah.
No one ever plans for that. I mean, no one ever plans for loss, you know?
Yeah.
And I suspect that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this encounter with this really devastating loss at such a young age probably made you understand, as you've already stated, that life is short, but that it is important to love people as much as you can while you have the time. Would you say that's true?
It's true, but there's things that even with that knowledge and with that, I took care of my mom the last 5 years of her life. And after she passed, I often think, oh, I could have spent more time with her, you know, but I'm trying to do business. I'm trying to do things. I'm trying to, you know, keep us in the house we live in, you know, trying to just live life and do, you know, business things. And so sometimes, well, I could have gone in and just took my laptop in and sat with her. She would have enjoyed that. And so there's, even with that, there's regret sometimes for, even when you do it completely right, there's always, I could have done more.
Yeah.
And so you always think about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can At least I do.
Yeah, I do as well. I mean, I'm in New Mexico. My family still lives outside of Chicago, and I just lost my father a few months ago. And I did go back for 2.5 weeks, almost 3 weeks in April. And you know, my brother and sister both said he waited for you because I came and he was in the dementia care unit and was doing fine. And then one day, I think a week in or a week and a half in of me being there, he just decided to stop eating. And I think I could have done more. I mean,
yeah
that's a whole other conversation, I'm going to tell you.
I know.
You know this. Can I ask, how did you end up where you're at now?
I went to Utah State to school. And then when I graduated, I decided I liked Utah.
It's beautiful.
I liked having all four seasons instead of just one season. And yeah. And so back to my dream job of getting in the FBI, I didn't make it. I had RK surgery done on my eyes before I graduated from college and was to correct my vision. I had perfect, you know, 20/20 in one eye, 20/25 in the other eye, clear up till I was like 53. And then I had to start wearing glasses again. But I found out after I had that surgery done that automatically disqualified me from the FBI.
Wait, why? What?
Because it was still considered experimental at the time. And they didn't want to put lots of money into an agent and then have him go blind.
Oh.
And so anyway, so I didn't get my dream job. That's why I end up with the bungee jump. And I don't know how I feel about it. I mean, obviously I love it because I'm watching crime dramas and all this stuff to get my feel throughout life. But I don't hate what I've done. I mean, I've, like I said, I fell back on the side of anything that crosses my path, good, bad, or ugly. I always ask, how can I monetize it? And I've just done well working for myself, never done the real job thing. And, you know, so that's what I've done. But man, when that happened, because we had an FBI agent friend that said the easiest way in the FBI is through accounting. And then once you get in, you apply to the jobs that open up, and then you're good. If you're good at it, you're going to move to whatever it is you want to be. You don't have to stay in the white collar industry. I'm like, okay, that's a good idea. I'm going to do that. When I went to school, I found out very quickly, I'm not very good at accounting. And I didn't really like accounting. And so I graduated in a degree that I didn't like and I wasn't good at to get in the FBI and then didn't get in. And so I was devastated. Once again, learning life lessons and just like, what do you do? You know, what do you do?
And what an incredible pivot to then jumping off into nets. And I mean, that is an incredible pivot. I don't know if anyone has ever said that to you, but wow. Talk about an unexpected outcome. You know, yeah. I'm still kind of just gobsmacked right now. I didn't know, first of all, that this was like an option for a vocation. I mean, back then, I don't know. I wonder if it still is an option for people. They probably design all these things on computers now.
Well, and so people ask me all the time, they hear about all the different rides that I've done and built and worked with. And they're like, so are you an engineer? I'm like, no, I graduated in accounting. And they can't make the connection. How does that work?
Good. It means you're like a mystery man.
I know, right?
Well, I'd love to ask you the main question of the podcast, which is I would so appreciate you sharing, you know, you can share more than one story if you feel like it, about something magical, mysterious, or miraculous that's happened in your life.
You know, and you're going to be the first one on a podcast to hear this story. Okay, so I don't know if you did your research on me or not.
I did a little bit, but I also like to be authentically surprised.
So I lost my lower left leg in 2024. March 25th, 2024, my lower left leg was amputated. Here is my leg. It has the Side Hustle Samurai on it. So it's tax deductible. But so when this, I found out this was going to happen, and people have heard the story about my amputation. That's not the big secret, but this is going to go into detail that I haven't shared a whole lot on a podcast at all. So when I found out this was going to happen was about October of 2023. And I had scheduled, what do you do? You're just like, okay, I'm not happy with this, but it's going to happen. So I scheduled my amputation for November 14th, I believe, of 2023. And then something told me, for several reasons, maybe the 14th is not a good time to do it, because people in my neighborhood are going to want to help me out. And it's the holidays. They're dealing with their, you know, so why help the holidays out by chopping off body parts? Maybe that's not the brightest idea, but I didn't want to be a burden when they're trying to have their holidays. Plus, I didn't want my holidays to be me sitting in a recliner, you know, not doing anything. And then you have the insurance issues. I would be going max out of pocket for the surgery and then max out of pocket again next year for the prosthetic. So why do that? That's stupid. Mm-hmm. So I changed my appointment to January 19th.
Okay.
January 12th, my wife had to have quadruple bypass. If I had had the surgery on the 14th, we wouldn't have found her issue. She could have died taking care of me. So the fact that I would, you know, we're going to say it's for other reasons, but it was just, you know, why do all these things and then have this happen? There was a reason for that. So then I had to postpone it again. I postponed it to February 29th. And I went to my pre-op appointment and the doctor says, well, we're closing down this clinic and we're only allowing one night stays. So they wanted to chop my leg off and send me home the next day. And I said, I'm a tough cowboy from New Mexico, but I ain't that tough. And so I canceled with him. I transferred down to what we call Utah Valley Hospital, a bigger hospital that actually has an acute care on the 11th floor. Mm. So the transfer to the acute care, if I was able to get in, was just going from one floor to another. Mm-hmm. And so I look back on this and I think about this, and people ask me all the time, how are you going through this with such a great attitude? Even the nurses in the hospital were talking about how good my attitude is. In 2 hours after my surgery, I'm in my bed in the patient's room. My nephew, who has kids of his own and does some woodwork, and he walked through with a wooden pirate sword. He walks through the door. He looks at me, looks at the sword. Too soon. And then he comes walking in. So the nurses were just laughing, and you know, they're just like, we can't believe your guys's your attitude. I'm like, well, what am I supposed to do? Be, you know, curled up here and crying? She says, it happens. Families are in here crying. But the reason I believe that I was able to do this, because I thought it was so divinely taken care of because of the stuff before. And then I expected the best, and the best happened. You know, the surgery went great. The recovery for the most part in the hospital went great. And then I went up to the acute care. So there's two types of care you could go to. One is like a nursing home, and they work with you maybe once or twice a week, or the acute care where they work with you three times a day. I didn't want to go to a nursing home. I wanted to go to the acute care. They accepted me in there 3 days. Normally that's a 10-day to 2-week stay. After the third day, they said, dude, you want to go home? You're good. And so I was ready too. I was like, get me out of this hospital. I want to have a full sleepless night, or have a full night of sleep, not being woke up at all hours of the night. And so I just believed everything was so divinely guided that I wasn't worried. Now that being said, I walked through those hospital doors that morning. That is the most terrifying thing I've ever done. Not jumping off a bungee tower with just hanging on. I mean, the way to explain it that is a little bit, that is over-exaggerated, not even a little bit over-exaggerated, but it helps you understand how I felt, is it's like a death row inmate walking to the death chamber to die. I would be walking in, but I wouldn't be walking out. I had postponed it from the 14th to the 19th to the 29th, and now we're on the 24th of March. I was asking my wife, hun, do you want to have another surgery? I want to postpone this again. I didn't know if I could walk through that morning, but I did. And I did it with as good of an attitude as I could have, because I was scared. I mean, it was scary.
I mean, I'm going to presume you had to have this surgery. There was no two ways about it. Go ahead.
So I was dropped from a ropes course back in 2012. And the belayer, it was at a personal development retreat in Canada. And so I get, when people ask me how I lost my leg, I tell them I didn't listen to my wife. And so my wife is big into feng shui.
Okay.
And I had this trip planned, purchased airline tickets. I was on my way to Canada. About a month before I was supposed to leave, she comes out of her office and she says, "You can't go." "What do you mean I can't go where?" "You can't go to Canada. It's a bad direction." "I can't live my life on your feng shui." And so she protested a second, went back in her office. And then she came back out again. She says, "No, this is a horrible direction. It could affect you for the rest of your life." Here we are. Obviously, I went. On the last day was a ropes course, and the ropes course was the beginning obstacle course. So the beginning was the ropes course, climbing in the trees and the cables and stuff. And you cross this cable and the belayer is going to belay you down. And she yelled up to me, "Okay, I'm ready. Just lean back and let go." I leaned back and let go. I went down and landed on my ankle. And this was suck it up. You know, you can make it, go ahead, finish, fight through the pain type of, place that we were at. And so they taped up my ankle with duct tape over my sock, and I finished the course. By that night, I could barely walk. In my tent, I couldn't sleep. The pain was so bad. I needed to get up and go pee, and you had to walk to the bathrooms. I couldn't walk. I crawled out on my hands and knees, peed by my tent, and crawled back in. The next day, I had two bus rides and a plane ride home with two big suitcases and crutches for someone 5'10". I'm 6'4". And by the time I got back to Utah, my leg was swollen clear to my knee. and I was running 102 degree fever.
Oh my gosh.
And this was a Friday. On Monday, we went to the doctor, got it x-rayed. They said it wasn't, they told me it wasn't broken, that it was just a bad sprain. And I should have asked questions, but I didn't. I mean, they're the doctor. They know, they looked at the x-rays. I didn't. But it was the worst pain I'd ever been in. I mean, I couldn't, I always thought, hey, I do a lot of work from the computer. I can do anything, even if I get hurt. I couldn't focus for like 6 weeks. The pain was so bad. I would go to physical therapy because this is just a sprain, right? They would put me in that big boot with lots of ice packs and stuff, and the air would go in and out and in and out. And as soon as they would pull it off, my leg would turn beet red. One of the physical therapists came over and she says, I thought you had a snake bite. That's what it looked like. And I'm like, no, this is just a sprain. In 2021, I ended up in the hospital with blood clots in my lungs. A whole nother story. But after that almost killed me, I said, okay, the blood clots came from my leg because my ankle didn't have this motion. And so the calf muscle never flexed enough to get the blood out of my leg. And so I ended up with blood clots. And anyway, after that happened, I was like, okay, I need to try and fix this ankle one way or another. What can I do? And so we had a CT scan done and found out that the ankle bone was actually crushed on the back and the front. And what was blocking the movement was the bone fragments of my ankle. And so I went to different orthopedic surgeons trying to figure out, okay, can I get an ankle replacement? Because there is such a thing as an ankle replacement. And they said, no, with what you have, there's... out of the five reasons I wouldn't give you an ankle replacement, you have three of them. Not a good idea. You're just going to need it fused when the pain gets bad enough. Now, once again, I said tough cowboy from New Mexico. And when the pain was bad enough, I went to set up an ankle fusion appointment. And the radiologist, he takes the first x-ray, and they're not supposed to tell you anything. You know, the x-ray tech, not the radiologist, the x-ray tech. And from behind his little partition, damn, you don't have an ankle bone. And so my ankle bone had disintegrated over the years enough that there was nothing left to fuse. And so the doctor came in, confirmed that there was no ankle bone, and he said, your choices are amputation, which is probably going to be a better life than you've had for 12 years, or it's going to be in a wheelchair. Because if you continue walking on this ankle, it's going to snap. Your tibia is going to snap because of the pressure, and you're going to be forced to have an emergency amputation. And anyway, so was it necessary? Yes. And I joked, you know, the pain was so bad that over those 12 years, that there's times that I joked, seriously kind of joked, I wish I could just chop the dang thing off. You know, I would see people with a prosthetic doing things that I couldn't do. I mean, it's like, man, I just wish I could chop the dang thing off. And surprise, here we are.
Thank you for sharing that story. That is horrifying. And I actually am a little flabbergasted that, I mean, I can't imagine the pain, but then that you lived with it for 12 years is also astounding to me. And that story of just the timing, that's what's remarkable. The timing of the November 14th, and you're like, no, there's something kind of telling me I just don't feel like this is right. And because of that, you know, everything else kind of unfurled from that, and it's with the best possible outcomes, I guess you could say.
Yeah. And like I said, I expected the best, and the best happened.
Yeah.
And it gave me a chance to, I mean, I had to serve my wife for several months before she had to serve me.
Yeah.
And so it just helped with our connection. And then I have people, you know, like I said, they comment on how I'm taking it. And I'm like, I see people that are worse off than me. And I just go, I'm glad I just had to have my leg cut off.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thankful for what I did have versus looking at other. I mean, I have a nephew that's worse off. I have a business partner that has been worse off. And I just go, man, I'm sure glad I just had to have my leg cut off.
Everyone, that's a wrap on my conversation with Bart Merrill. I'm so grateful to him for sharing his stories, being so open, and letting me get a peek behind the curtain that is Bart's life. If you want to find out more about this intrepid adventurer, this human being that in the past jumped off very high places because it was fun, well, there will be a link. Many links in the episode show notes. Do yourself a favor and check out what this human is doing in the world. Thanks everyone for listening. If you can, and if you have a moment, please do subscribe to this podcast and then leave a rating or review wherever you find the pod. And as usual, I'm going to go out with my tagline, which is, thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Bart. I mean, honestly, I could say, be like Bart and be brave and do things that scare you. But what I'm really going to say is, be like Bart and be okay with the process. In that, if something doesn't feel right, if the timing feels off, if something just doesn't feel right with your heart and what's going on, listen to that intuition you have, that superpower you have, and then delay. There is nothing wrong with delaying and taking a step back and saying, hey, I got to think about this, or hey, I might need a little more time, or hey, it's just not a good time for me. Be like Bart and listen to your intuition, and I guarantee you, it will never steer you wrong. I mean, it is a superpower after all.
I told you I'm the side hustle samurai.
Yes.
Okay. I found out this was going to happen. After the shock and awe was over, my attitude was, okay, I don't like this, but it's got to happen. There's nothing I can do about it. So how can I monetize it? 6 months post-op, I contracted with my prosthetist to help people go through what it is they're going to have to go through when they get their leg cut off.
Okay.
And I was in a prosthetist appointment with him, and I said, Scott, you know, I interviewed three other prosthetists before I chose you. One of them had a guy that I could talk to, could ask, how bad's this going to hurt? What about phantom pain? What about my bathroom? Do I need to change him? I could ask these questions. Scott, you don't have a guy. I'm your guy. And that started our conversation. If I hadn't thought about it before, I don't know if I would have took the chance when the opportunity, I mean, he didn't come to me and ask me, hey, I just said, hey, Scott, you know what? You don't have a guy and I'm your guy. And we've been doing that for a year and a half now. I said, and I told him, I don't want a job. I don't want a real job. I just want to be on retainer. You send me the numbers. I go talk to the people. I check their bathroom, see what adjustments they might need to make, answer the questions that they have that, you know, they're going down the YouTube rabbit hole trying to find the answers to.
Yes.
And so, you know, that's also part of my attitude.
Yep.
Taking the things that life hands you, you know, I say when life hands you lemons,
yeah.
If you're going to be making lemonade, you might as well build a lemonade stand and sell the stuff. And so anyway, a little different sidetrack, but
No, brilliant, brilliant. You're right. You're totally right. You're right. Why not build a lemonade stand? I mean, this is a perfect segue. You've kind of sort of talked a little bit about the work you do, but would you like to share any more?
So I just help people create financial security by monetizing the stuff that they already know and do. When I work with someone, I don't come into them with an agenda. Hey, come join my network marketing company or come build this type of business or this type of business. We're an open script. We work. I ask them questions. What do you like to do? What do you need to do? What are you already doing? How can you monetize one, two, or maybe three of those things?
Yeah.
And a lot of times we don't see it because it's too close. Mm. For me, it comes naturally because my dad, like I said, he was a pig farmer, but he wasn't just a pig farmer. He had his hands in many different things, usually in the agricultural industry because that's what he loved. But he was part owner of a dairy farm in Idaho, part owner of a mushroom warehouse in Utah, part owner of a produce warehouse in Arizona, which used to be where Diamondback Stadium now stands. And so when Diamondback Stadium wanted that property, a lot of money changed hands.
I bet.
And so he never set me down and taught me the birds and the bees of business. He showed me by example. And anytime I tried to do something, he was there to encourage me and help me. Mm-hmm. And so I was volunteering at a drug rehab center in Salt Lake. And basically, are you familiar with Toastmasters?
I am. Yeah.
So I was doing a Toastmasters style club or session at this drug rehab center, teaching them how to tell their stories. And I was listening to Jen tell her story. And she talked about how growing up, she thought her life was the same as everybody else's, because when they were out and about, they were fairly normal family. You know, nobody would have guessed what happened at home.
Okay.
And she thought everybody else went home to the same abuse and neglect, and they were just normal when they're out and about. It wasn't until she went to college that she realized that, no, people actually had pretty good lives. And I'm sitting there listening to her story, and I had been triggered a day before that by a post I saw on Facebook that I believe my sister denies it, but I believe my sister posted it, and it was how to live on less than $28,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I said, why would I even read that? Tell me how to make more than $28,000 a year. Don't tell me how to suffer through life. And so I was sitting there and listening to Jen, and I'm like, it's the same with how to make money and how to deal with life. If you didn't grow up with my dad or someone like my dad, you don't think like I do. And it comes natural to me. I need to share with people how to monetize the stuff that comes across their path every day. And that's when I started writing my book. It's called Monetize Your Mindset. And it's not a what to do book. It's a how to think book. Mm. And how to start to, we jokingly say, how to think like Bart. But maybe you don't want to think like Bart after you heard I jumped off a bungee tower just hanging on with my hands. But, and so that's what I do. I help people just recognize the stuff that's right there. And I don't tell them what to do. I just get the wheels turning, and it's amazing what people can remember. Oh, I know how to do that. Maybe I could turn that into a stream of income.
Yeah.
And I just help people recognize the stuff that is already there.